Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 114 of A Life in Ruins podcast. I am David. I am alive. I am not off the podcast. I am here. I am just very busy. I am here today with my co-host, Connor Johnen. Carlton cannot be here today. He was doing field school, or running it, and then he got hit by a tornado, and we haven't heard from him since. So hope the kid's okay. Also, we are here with Vincent Batista, who is a Neanderthal extraordinaire expert person. A funny story about this, which we can get into, Vincent. I posted a thing about Neanderthals, and I got a DM from somebody who was like, hey, actually, the information is X, Y, or Z. And I was like, oh, really? It turned out to be the man we're speaking to today. And I was like, oh, and then from that day on, we actually were really good Instagram friends. We sent each other memes, got a lot in common, love dogs. So we decided to get him on the show. And you are a student of Wolpoff because you got your PhD at the University of Michigan. And Wolpoff was a good friend of me and Connor's biological anthropology teacher. So welcome to the show, Vincent. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been, you know, been a pretty big lurker on the ethnocynology page. And one of my good friends, Jim, actually sent me your Instagram like long before I lurked and then like eventually lurked. And now we send each other Sopranos memes. So
that's, I think, the majority of our relationship. And cuisine.
a lot of cuisine, yeah.
Yeah, he's a good dude.
Connor's a cuisine fan.
Yeah. I want to clarify that Carlton is alive and he did text us and he did not directly get hit by the tornado. His town did. He did not fly. He did not strap himself to a pipe using his belt as seen in the movie Twister. It's not something he did. So he's all right. He just doesn't have any cell service. So, Vincent, what really got you into and kind of got you interested in anthropology growing up, if you don't mind answering that?
I think a big thing is like my dad is an immigrant from Italy. And so I think people who are from immigrant families are kind of positioned in this weird spot where they're almost primed to do cultural anthropology from the minute they're born. It's wild because like you live in, you know, you have a foot in each room, so to speak, and you're on the threshold between being like American and being something else. And so like that was interesting. But also, we were very privileged to be able to go back to Italy a bunch when I was a kid. And the archaeology there is everywhere. Like, you can't swing a dead cat without finding. Like, for example, my father, when he was a kid, was like digging in the backyard. And he found a sword. Literally just found a sword in the backyard. And like, he and one of his buddies who like, his buddy owned like a goat. My dad told me that like he was like riding on this goat, like pretending to joust with this sword as a kid. Like he's a kid. He had no archaeological training or anything. He was just digging in the yard and found a sword and stuff like that happens all the time. But like going there, seeing like Greek ruins, this is from southern Italy, a huge Greek presence there from Magna Graecia. All the Roman stuff, a lot of Samnite sites, things like that. So I've always kind of just been interested in like human past. And also human variation in terms of what that means biologically and culturally. When I was an undergrad, I wanted to do psychology and I had to take an Anthro 101 course. And I was just completely fascinated by it. I wasn't doing too well academically. And two of these Anthro professors kind of just took me under their wing. One was Dan Adler, who's an archaeologist, works in Armenia, does a lot of Pleistocene stuff. And the other guy's Gidon Hartman, who is a stable isotope specialist. I don't know if he did it on purpose, but I was like really struggling and he like took a shine to me and let me work in his lab and cut up bones and drill teeth. One of the things we were working on was with gazelle teeth from a Amud cave in Israel. And Amud is Israel. In Israel is really interesting because it has Neanderthal occupational horizons sandwiched between what people might call modern human occupational horizons. They're basically moving in and out of this cave system. And the Neanderthals from down there are interesting because they don't look like Neanderthals from Western Europe. They're like probably a little bit taller. Their faces are a little bit different. Chances are, like what we know now from like paleogenomics, like these were probably admixed Neanderthals with way more African ancestry than we would have expected. But anyway, so we are working on doing like paleoecology, looking at essentially where Neanderthals were hunting these gazelle and looking at oxygen isotopes in their teeth. And they got me super into science and I was really into archaeology. I was going to be an archaeologist, do archaeology. I did a, you know, I was concerned about not being able to get my PhD because my grades were not up to snuff. I had like a, I think I graduated with like a below a 3.0 GPA. Like this is like very clearly a case of like undiagnosed ADHD kid, which is me.
Yeah.
Subsequently diagnosed, but like I was not good at school, but like I knew all my stuff, but like, you know, wasn't really performing. And then Gidon was like, yeah, you should just apply to a master's program in the UK. Like you're going to have to probably take out student loans, whatever, but like you'll get a master's in like 1 or 2 years. You'll learn a lot. It'll be a good experience. So I did that and I went to Durham. And the way that the ArcSci program worked there at the time, I don't know if it still is around, but you essentially do like little rotations and do different projects. And I really, really liked the ancient DNA stuff. And then it stuck. And then I became a geneticist. And now I do computational biology for a living. So it's been like a very meandering path. But like after that, I took a year off. I worked at Yale in the molecular biology department and feel a little better in the lab. So I was doing some CRISPR stuff, and then I got accepted to Michigan, and I was co-advised by Milford, who's like bones dude, teeth dude, statistics dude, and Abby Bigham, who, you know, at the time was a young PI. She's a obviously a woman PI in genetics, and like, you know, that was like really cool to me to see like a person not too much older than me doing really, really cool science with like very clear, like archaeologically and cultural anthropologically grounded research questions, like saying, we know people have been in the Andes for this long. We know people have survived in this hypoxic environment for this long. Like, what is the signal that that leaves on the human genome? And like that absolutely fascinated me. So Abby and Milford were my advisors, and my PhD project was ultimately, half of it was statistical genetics and the other half was skeletal biology. So now I'm done. Now I'm doing a non-traditional postdoc at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and I play with computers all day. It's pretty sweet.
The kid's wicked smart.
Thanks, yeah.
lots to unpack there, dude. You've done quite a lot. I want to, and Connor, you can dive in here too, but the beginning, you mentioned, well, one, that you grew up Italian and grew up around a lot of Italians, and like our very niche humor that we send in memes is like that kind of culture. But I find it really interesting. Like, I grew up around so many Italians in New York, and like my friends were like, my babysitter only spoke Italian. So it's just like, I got really interested in, of course, like Greek and Roman history. And then, you know, I'd never been to Italy then. I went later on in my life. Yeah. Just super interested in the different cultures in New York. Cause there's like that. And like my neighbors are literally from another country, and it was super cool. The cooking was wild. And I think that made me want to be an anthropologist too. Like, I'm just so
100%.
Interest. Yeah. And I think that's a common thing we see here. And what I was going to lead that into too is like your GPA in college. Like, I think Connor and I had a very similar thing. Like, we just got taken under a wing by a professor because we were, you know.
Yeah.
And what's, you know, the word, like, Connor?
I don't know. I mean, my problem was like, I discovered beer and like, and like partying, but also like, so I'm from Connecticut, right? I was born in New Haven, raised in New Haven. My dad was a lab tech at Yale and a union organizer when I was born, and we lived in a 3-family home, right? So like I grew up with my grandparents, and my grandfather was a partisan, like very, very hardcore left wing, like probably the polar opposite of the stereotypical Italian American guy in the Northeast, right? Like the conservative Catholic sort of thing.
For the audience, what's a partisan?
Basically like anti-fascist.
Got it.
They were socialists because, you know, but that he was tended more towards anarcho-syndicalism, just more sort of part and parcel for Southern Italy. Like Southern Italy were from very rural, very agricultural. Socialism never really took hold down there. Anarchism did more. And there's a big misconception that anarchy and anarchism mean the same thing, which they don't. We can talk about it later. But so I grew up in a house where like there was an inborn sense of solidarity with people who were underrepresented. Like my grandfather taught me about the Black Panthers. Like, and they were in New Haven. They were active when they moved to the States. Like, you know, and he was a marksman. He was a very good shot. And like, we used to harvest rabbits in the backyard and like eat them and like grow our own food. And like seeing that, like that was an important formative experience for me. And like, that was, I think, really critical in getting me invested in the outdoors. So then like when I went to college at UConn, all my time was spent outside. Like, you know, obviously partying and stuff, whatever, but Northeast Connecticut is a really, really good place to like learn about yourself and learn about the environment. And I think kind of like hindsight's 2020, but like that was important as an archaeology undergrad. Mm-hmm. Like part of our curriculum was like the archaeology of New England, Southern New England. So like a lot of stuff in Rhode Island and Connecticut. And like walking around and like seeing the landscape and understanding how historical forces of colonialism and things like that shaped the history of Southern New England for the time period we were working on. Like that was really, really important to me. And I think like I wouldn't have gotten that anywhere else. So like, it seems very different, like anti-fascist, you know, 1940s Italy, but colonialism in, you know, the 1600s in New England, they're really similar in a lot of ways. You have people coming in without permission, and changing everything, changing life, these power dynamics. And I think also kind of having this almost Marxist ideology at a young age, I think that was also a reason for me to go to Michigan. I think that was a, you know, it's pretty strong in the archaeological curriculum there. And I think having all these questions at a relatively early stage in my career, it was a lot going on. And so like, it was weird because like I wouldn't hand in my homework assignments from my history classes, but I would like read all the stuff I was assigned and then more, and like go to the library and get lost in the library, and like wasn't doing well academically, but like I knew so much, but I was like super excited, which I couldn't do the work. And I think part of that is because like, and also I think that might be why archaeology was so appealing to me, is because like it was physical. Mm. And like that physicality is like really important for a lot of people. Like only in our society do we like demonize kids for not being able to sit in a chair for 8 hours a day. You know what I mean? Like no other learning, no other like context of learning does that. And I don't know. And that's something that like, I don't know, it just really stuck with me. And I think it had an important role in shaping the way I look at like education, academia, but like, I don't know, it's all one thing.
Yeah. And I feel the same way, as like the physical, the lab work, the not sitting in the classroom part was the most important part. And to me, or being outside or doing the field work, you know, that stuff is what really got me excited about archaeology. It wasn't sitting in a lab, listening to someone lecture about Neanderthals, which are fascinating. But if you sit in a hot room with like 600 or 200 other people, like it's impossible to actually get inspired and feel that inspiration for certain folks. I mean, certain people love that crap, you know, and that's all to them. But I didn't really get the inspiration until I like physically touched
100%.
The archaeology, the bones, all of it is like, that was super important to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I bet David is the same way.
Oh yeah. Like I was a terrible student until I did my first, not field school, but like field season at Topper. And like just being around other like-minded college students that wanted to do that. And like you're sitting outside around a fire drinking. It's just like, it's what humans are supposed to do. And archaeology like really lends, or like you can do that with archaeology while also getting a degree. And people are like, damn, that's a cool job. And I'm like, it's, you just hang.
Yeah, I agree.
Did you feel like grad school was more like a place that you thrived more?
I mean, I definitely,
because it was so.
But like,
yeah.
I don't know. I have really mixed feelings about Michigan. The state is fine. I don't have a problem with the state, but that program, it is like really a bubble. Like, I learned a whole. So maybe I'll first start off like what I loved about that program. It's a four-field program. So for those who don't know what that means, it's you learn cultural anthropology, you learn linguistics, you learn human evolution, biological anthropology, and you learn archaeology. And so like most of us on the bio and arc side, like our dissertations, our research are like so intertwined. Like for example, a lot of my TAs, like for my early courses in grad school, they were archaeologists teaching human evolution classes. And that's really important. They're, you know, they're a year older than you, but they're teaching you, they're like, they're really good at telling you, like, okay, yeah, the human evolution stuff is fine. Environment is really important. Culture is really important. They create feedback loops, and those feedback loops drive evolution. Evolution drives these feedback loops. And it's like, that's super important. And this isn't to say that's unique to a four-field program. But then going over to a linguistics class and, you know, seeing how much they actually know about cognitive biology, and then going over to a cultural anthropology and seeing how much they know about medical anthropology, and like, those are all intertwined, which is one of the reasons why I really like teaching 101, for example, because like, these are 19-year-old students, 20-year-old students, some of them are 40-year-old students, first-year graduates, or first-year undergrads, 40 years old. Mm-hmm. But like, the way that you see people excited about anthropology and like realizing that like something from their anatomy physiology class ties in really well with their archaeology class, that's incredible. Like, that is the coolest thing in the world. And like, seeing the light bulb go off is like one of the most like gratifying experiences.
That's awesome.
And so like, I was really laissez-faire about like my grading. I don't think I ever failed anybody. I think I gave out like one D. I don't
probably deserved it.
No, and the thing is, like, a lot of these students like would come back and they'd be like, all right, what can I do to fix this? I'd be like, write an essay, and they do it, and then they get a B. Like,
sweet.
Yeah, like, I don't know, like the, and also because I was that student who like didn't do well. And so I'm like very sympathetic. But like, majority of the time, like, I think like my average for my sections each year was like over an 85. Over a 90. Like, it was insane because of how stoked these students were to be in a program like that. And like, the undergrad program really, really empowers these students there. And it was like so cool to be like a TA or the instructor of record for undergrads at a program like Michigan. And like, that was super, that was worth it. That was worth everything.
We will be right back. This is episode 114. You're about to listen to Chris Webster sell you something. Buy it, please.
Yeah.
Welcome back to episode 114 of A Life in Ruins podcast. We are here with Vincent Batista, the cool guy. We're very excited to have him on. He finished the last segment talking about what he enjoyed about the University of Michigan and the program as it is. We wanted to ask you, what were some things that you maybe were like less excited about or you kind of had some issues with while you were there?
Yeah, a couple. The structure of courses was kind of tough. So like, some of the courses that we had to take, we had like a four hour long cultural anthropology class on Wednesday mornings, like at 8 a.m. until lunch or something like that. And that was tough because like, a lot of the students in the program who were taking that class were like a little bit further on. They'd done so much more of the reading and like, it was easier for them. Whereas like, there was like six or seven bioanthro or archanth people like in that class that were our first years. And like, that was tough. Like, the course was called Trads or Traditions of Ethnology. And I think it's an important class. You read Karl Marx. Like, you read Charles Darwin. You also read, you know, like, very foundational things in ethnological research. And so, like, that's cool. Because it's a four-field program, whatever. Like, that class was brutal. Like, super, super long graduate school classes are, like, not fun. Like, not lives in them. And then another thing was the way prelims were set up. It's brutal. The way that these exams are, not everybody can write well. Not everybody can write like 12 essays in a week and like have them be good to be able to defend it. Like, that's tough.
Mm-hmm. Prelims for the audience is the stuff you do right before you become a candidate, right? For your PhD.
Yeah.
It's like trials.
Ours was like two. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was like two parts. So like, our first one was like, I think it was the end of our first or second year. It's basically you do like a bunch of essays with a committee, which is like, it's supposed to get you able to write fast and all that stuff. And then the second part is you basically write an NSF and then like a grant. And then like, you need to propose a project and like defend that. And like, that was helpful and that was cool. It was really tough, but like, whatever. But just the way that was like, it's tough because we had a really big cohort. There's like 8 bioanth people, I think, in my cohort. So like, getting it such that like everybody's committee members would be around, it would all be done at the same time. That was really tough. Mm-hmm. But also like, I just think that it's like not a good structure. Not a lot of people thrive in that sort of like environment. And like, that's like, teaching is about, my philosophy about teaching is like, it should be done in a way that empowers people, elevates people, and like challenges them, but like does it in a way that like they can approach it in a manner that helps them grow. And like, I don't feel like I really grew from that. Like, I passed and I had to rewrite like all my essays. My grandmother died the next week. So I was like really not in a good place. And like, that was just what you had to do, because like, and you can't like stop. You can't like pause, because all the rest of your cohort's doing it, you know? So like that. And then also, it's so cold. Michigan is so freezing. Like, my thin Mediterranean blood, like all the olive oil just like coagulated and just like, wasn't really good. Wasn't really good at all. I watched a lot of hockey games, so that was good. But like, cold. It's like, I think I have like seasonal affective disorder, genuinely. Like, I just, like, it just, like, when you're in the lab all day or in class all day, you don't see the sun for like a week.
You're just a pasty, like, shell like, of a human. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like a Pleistocene guy, like, in the, you know, in between like glacial cycles. I got trapped in the Swabian Alps. I'm living in Vogelherd Cave, just chewing on carcasses.
Fermenting. Well, I guess that's why Oatsy was a little later, but maybe that's why he was like, I need to see the freaking sun, and he just went up into the mountains trying to get above the clouds, and then he got popped.
He got shot.
Everyone thinks Oatsy's so
first Bond movie is Oatsy the Iceman.
I see, he got whacked, dude. He was whacked. Hey, also,
let me tell you something. Look, we're gonna take a long walk. We're gonna go up the road south. We're gonna have a picnic. Don't worry about bringing stuff. We got all the gabagool.
Yo, that's perfect. We need to make that a movie. Also, I was gonna say,
which in Neapolitan means uncle. So
really. Are you from Naples?
Is this a coincidence? My dad was born in Caserta, which is like in the mountains, like north of Naples. But it's all part of the same kingdom of two Sicilies.
Italy's got a lot of stuff going on at all times in history. Giuseppe Garibaldi. We'll talk about that in another episode. But Garibaldi. That was Garibaldi. We're gonna edit that out. I was in Rome, and the guy was like, that little cannon, like, that's like to celebrate like Giuseppe Garibaldi, like it's every day at noon. And I was like, wait, I know that. Oh, right. Italy had like 45 different like warring family states at some point. It's basically like, you know, dude, Game of Thrones.
Garibaldi lived on Staten Island as a candle maker.
Did he?
Dude was a candle maker.
He was a Staten Island boy?
Bro, I mean, we haven't left ever since, but... But here's what you don't know is like Garibaldi was also involved in the American Civil War.
I did not know that.
Garibaldi like became super, super popular. He was involved in the American Civil War and like the Uruguayan like Civil War or something like that. But the dude, he's like a very complex figure, because like when he went to southern Italy, we're all like sick, like, you know, we're gonna like no longer be like, you know, a part of the same empire as like Peru or whatever, gonna be cool, whatever. And then we got completely screwed over. Like, lost, like, we had way less autonomy, got a language forced on us that wasn't ours. And like, still, if you look at like pretty much any indicator for like development or health or whatever in Italy, northern Italy and southern Italy are basically two different countries. Southern Italy is basically like not even in the same, like, northern Italy is like Europe. Yeah, right. Northern Italy is Europe. Southern Italy is its own thing, man. And I love
Mediterranean.
It. Yeah, we're Mediterranean, dude. We got like the best food and Napoli's excellent soccer team. So
yeah, go. Who's that? So yeah, it is insane how like prelims just are like there to like, it's like this like ancient way to like screw people over and beat you down.
Because it's the way it's been, is like why those things exist, is kind of the feeling I get. You're right, Connor.
I had to do it, so you got to do it.
Yeah, let's all suffer, because we all suffered. And, you know, let's just keep beating that mental health down till,
it's like,
you know.
Ableist. And, like, and here's the thing. It's like, it's ableist, like, on its own. But, like, I think about students who have children. Think about students who have English as a second language. Or, like, students that, you know, come from, like, I'll be the first person to admit and acknowledge that, like, I have a mountain of privilege. Like, that is it, full stop. There are no mm-hmm. conditionals attached to that. If I had this hard of a time doing it, and, like, I have a lot more at my disposal, then, like, how else are other people doing? And, like, I have a lot of friends who did great. Kicked them out of the, you know, did a great job. But, like, I also have a lot of friends who had an equally terrible time. And this isn't, like, unique to Michigan. This is, like, the American graduate student experience.
You're right. It's tough. And, like, I had just, like, crippling anxiety. And I will also admit, like, I'm also privileged growing up, like, with the family that I had. And, like, it's hard still at that. And, like, I know there's other students who have to work full time to do it. And it's just, like, it's grueling. And that does give me respect for people that have PhDs, because it's like you went through the freaking ringer. But yeah. Also, like, it doesn't need to be that hard.
100%. Yeah. I'm glad it's over with. That's all I'm going to say.
I'm done. Well, let's dig into then. In class, in biological anthropology class, we had Jim Ahern, Dr. Jim Ahern. He went to Michigan as well. And side note, I want the audience to know Michigan is, like, always has been, and it still is, like, one of the top schools for anthropology. So, like, that's why it's also, like, such a challenge there, and why, like, our professor went there, and, like, the two guys we're about to talk about, and Vincent himself. But anyway, Jim Ahern, our professor, had us do, very interestingly, like, our second week of class, our archaeological and anthropological pedigree, and to trace back our teachers to Boaz. And, like, it's pretty sick. We're, like, 5 degrees of separation away from Boaz in a lot of senses. As a student, it's kind of like, you know, you could trace back to Musashi or, like, Yoda or something. Also, I think Boaz is canceled, but anyway.
Well, like we figured out that, like, we're, like, a degree of separation from, like, Binford, right? We're one step away from Binford.
Man, Binford. Ah, oh, what are you gonna do about Binford?
He's a wild child.
He was.
But yeah, let's go back.
Yeah, so the Binford thing, yeah, we have to do a whole episode on Binford. I think Bob talked about it a bunch on his, but yeah, what struck me as cool was I really liked Jim's take on human evolution. I learned quite a bit. I also, that's the best grade on a paper I ever got, and I wrote it about dog domestication, and he was like, this is the shit. And just, like, the way he would explain biology and how it worked was awesome. But he learned that all from Milford Wolpoff. And he would be like, Wolpoff? Every day. Like, we would drink every time he said it.
That was awesome.
Yeah. So, like, when you hit me up about that Neanderthal thing and you said you're a Wolpoff student, I was like, immediately, like, okay, I take this guy very seriously. And his information is probably more correct because you specifically study it. But, like, it's weird because I, you know, he's got a pedigree. I should listen to him. It sounds kind of like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But, and I, like, I'm like the inverse of that. So, like, I think I pretty much only said it because I was like, so if I, as I remember it, like, you were talking about multi-regionalism, right? And mm-hmm. I think the context was, I was like, Milford himself told me this sort of thing. So it wasn't like I was trying to name drop, but I'm like, gang, like, this is from the source, like, no, not being filtered out through, like, Chris Stringer or, like,
right.
Anybody else, like, this is, like, Milford.
What was your experience working with him? How?
No, he's the man. He's great. I just went over his house for lunch last month. He hosted me. Rachel Gasperi, who's a professor at, I think, Central Michigan. Awesome. Like, I aspire to be like them when I'm grown up. About to turn 31, but I'm not a grown up. But Milford, you know, Milford's interesting because, like, you know, he's like gritty. Like, you know, he reminds me of my dad. Like, people think he's, like, bellicose. But he's not. He's excited. People are like, he's talking over me. I'm like, he's excited. He's excited. He loves teaching and he's excited and he's invested. Like, he's not talking over you because he's like, first of all, he's not talking over you. Second of all, he's excited. That's why he's loud and stuff. And, like, as you know, that's how I am too. And so, like, we meshed really well. And, like, he sometimes just, like, in class would, like, intentionally say things because he knew that I knew they were wrong. Right. Mm. So you, like, have some professors who would, like, do the Socratic thing. Like, oh, why do you think that is? And Milford would be like, what if I told you this thing, which is egregiously incorrect and, like, factually, you can demonstrably say it's not true. And he would do it anyways. And that's, like, a really important teaching technique, I think, for, like, people to learn, like, the way that I do. And it was awesome. And, like, it's also worth mentioning I had Abby as my co-advisor and, like, they were a really good balance. And I really think, like, for people just about to get their PhD, get a co-advisor. It, like, is so nice. Having, like, like a balance.
That's what I did.
You know what I mean? Yeah, it's great. Milford was awesome.
Yeah.
And he was a really good teacher. He was really tough, but I grew substantially because I had him as a professor. And I think he challenged me really in the right ways. And like also being able to teach for him for many years and like be his lab manager, it was great. Yeah. And like, you know, it was awesome. And like, what people don't know about him, he was like one of the first biological anthropologists to like really use a computer for a dissertation. He took like all these measurements on thousands and thousands of teeth and then like on punch cards, put them through a computer. And like did
damn
big data. It was like a big data project for the time. And like that's huge. And so like he's always been a really big advocate, one of like younger people. He's like younger people are probably right. Like just listen to what young people have to say. And two, he's been a huge advocate for like computational biology. Like even without saying it, he's like, you need to learn how to do statistical computing and do it. And like that,
yeah.
That is something that not like all I do now in my job in a clinical and translational epidemiology unit. Nothing related to anthropology. All I do is computational biology because he recognized it as a worthy tool set. Like, look at the way that archaeology is going. Like, there are machine learning papers in archaeology. I would not have anticipated that 10 years ago. Some of them aren't good. Yeah, no. A lot of them are incredible.
So along that line, what I was getting at with the pedigree thing is like, not necessarily that it's like, oh, he descends from this person, therefore I should trust him. But like, Wolpoff taught my teacher and he has... like the way we view the world is very similar. Right. And like, I like understanding that. And like, once like I knew you were a Wolpoff student, we were immediately friends, but also we were friends just cause like, you know, we were talking and sending memes and stuff and dogs. Yeah. But like, it's just when you meet an anthropologist that thinks similarly and like you have the same lens of the world, your conversations are like fire. Cause you can just, it's just so awesome. And like everything you just said, like is like, yeah, it's like looking at the world through like a computational sense. Like, why not look at it this way? And like the way he's teaching and things. And
dude,
obviously,
yeah, I think 100%. Yeah. I was gonna say, but I think it's also interesting when you run into people of the either opposite school or different school, and you have those conversations as well. Because obviously,
yeah,
we are conditioned a little bit by our teachers and by who we study underneath. So we have this, like you said, this worldview.
Yeah,
and it's fun to ask what other people are viewing and how they're doing it, as long as it's done in like a respectful and like good way. I mean, I think that's, it's fun to do that sometimes, to be like, okay, what, just give me the speech. Give me the elevator speech of like why you guys are correct on this topic, right, et cetera.
Yeah.
I think that's,
And speaking of the elevator speech, I would love to pick your brain, and Connor would too, about Neanderthals and everything you know about them in the next segment. He is currently beating his chest like a gorilla as if he's to say, yeah, I'm the guy for that. All right. We'll see you guys on the other side.
Sub-adult gorilla.
Welcome back to episode 114 of A Life Endurance Podcast. We're here with Vincent Batista, the man, the myth, the legend. Also here with Connor. You guys know Connor. I've already done this interview.
Not so mythical, not so legendary, you know. I'm here.
But he's here. So, Neanderthals, the war in Iraq. Like, let's pick Neanderthals first. But also, question. Do you think, I got two questions. Are Neanderthals Homo sapiens, or are they Homo neanderthalensis? And then two, what's the deal with only having one string of DNA from Neanderthals? And then three, was the sex consensual?
Okay, let's do this again. So, number one, yeah, they're Homo sapiens. Like, there's probably more Neanderthal DNA walking around on this planet now than there ever was in the past. Fact of the matter is, we not only mix with them, we mix with them every time we ran into them. All the genetics point to the fact that, first of all, not only have we mixed with them recursively, but other human populations like Denisovans have Neanderthal ancestry at the population level. So when you find like Denny, who was like the Neanderthal Denisovan hybrid, not a hybrid because it's the same species. One. Two, the Denisovan ancestry contained Neanderthal ancestry, and the Neanderthal ancestry, I'm pretty sure, also contained Denisovan ancestry. So it was like mixed on both sides. So essentially what you're saying is like, if somebody from like Western-ish Eurasia and Central-ish Eurasia mixed with one another, that's what Denny, that Denisovan is. So,
okay.
Yeah, they're the same species. We're the same species. We even find their ancestry in Africa. There are Neanderthal African components, or Neanderthal ancestry components in Africa. And for a long time, we were like, oh, this is because of like gene flow within the last couple hundred years, which is like a good hypothesis, right? But like they look at these haplotypes and the haplotypes are way too old to be recent and they're found all over this. So like there's neanderthal ancestry in Africa. We're the same species. You know, if we adopted the position that we were the same and then use that as the null hypothesis, we wouldn't even have to have this conversation. But because we come from the position that human populations are different, we have to find evidence to support that we're different. And that's not the case. Like, we are different skeletally. Like, Neanderthals from, like the La Pharisee Neanderthal, that's your idea of a stereotype Neanderthal. Of course they don't look the same as anybody else. The dude was like an old guy with, like, bone degeneration. He's missing teeth. Of course it didn't look like it. It's like if you took your grandfather, your great-grandfather, right? You like took a CAT scan of his skull and took a CAT scan of a Maasai person and you're like, oh yeah, they're different species. Like, yeah. No, not at all, dude. Like, it, you know, like my whole thing is like, because you cannot divorce anthropology from a colonial imperial past, we have to do so much work to, like, one, make sure that our research isn't, like, co-opted by white supremacists, but two, like, we have to undo all the trash that happened in the past 200 years, dude. And, like, it's, like, so much more work. And then you have, like, very well-respected, established archaeologists, like, and geneticists who, like, publish stuff. And I'm like, oh, my God, how do you have a job, dude? How do you have a job? One geneticist who's like, you know, apparently thinks, you know, everybody thinks this guy, where he walks, like tulips emerge from the earth or something. This guy is like, you know, whatever. They did a paper and like the author in question was like, oh, it seems that like what we're showing is that like people who live in a place, they don't necessarily have ancestry from that place. And they were talking about like Beaker culture migrations into England, right? And they're like, as we can see, this bell beaker, like, we see like a huge genomic replacement, right? And like, so like, you see this huge amount of ancestry coming in from continental Europe into the UK. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, it's a replacement. It's like, no, it's not a replacement. It's admixture. You have people who have a different subsistence method, different lifestyle. There was probably, you know, 90 of these agriculturalists for every 10 of these like Mesolithic people. Maybe it's not a surprise that 90% of their ancestry is from continental Europe with these agro-pastoralists and like 10% local ancestry. Like, people don't weight these papers by population size or anything like that. So like when you look at Neanderthal ancestry, like if somebody has like, you know, a fraction of Neanderthal ancestry, like, oh, yeah, there was probably like 2 or 3 Neanderthals for every 100 Africans. So like maybe it's not a huge surprise that there's not that much Neanderthal ancestry at any point, not any population. But so like, I can go on about this for hours. But that's number one. Same species.
Cool.
What was number two?
So like I talked about this on TikTok. There's the idea that it's either only female Neanderthal genetics are what passed, or that they were the only ones that were viable, or it was only the males that were viable. I can't recall. And there's the mule thing.
So, yeah. So they're like, oh, because there's no Neanderthal mitochondria, like no female matrilines from Neanderthals that survived. Fine. The problem with using uniparentally inherited markers is they don't mix, right? Like your mitochondrial haplogroup is your mitochondrial haplogroup from your mom. That's going to go on forever, right? Your whole genome is what mixes, right? So these, like, you have these chromosomes and they, you know, do the thing. That was one of the reasons why, like, when the first ancient DNA papers came out, people were like, there's no genetic evidence for Neanderthal ancestry in living humans. It's like, yeah, because you looked at the mitochondria and those don't mix. Right. So like there could be some possible like biological incompatibilities, like with the pelvis, as some people have thought, whatever. But chances are it's probably just that there's really strong selection of mitochondria. Like there are other, you know, there are non-human species where you have like admixture and you have like one of the mitochondrial haplogroups completely like going under selection, like completely replacing all the other mito, like, for example, there's like lake trout or something like that. These fish have like these Arctic char, which is like a really, really different species that they sometimes hybridize with. They have complete replacement in some of these populations, these lakes in like remote northern Canada. And like mitochondria are super important. Like that's the powerhouse of the cell, man. Like how can you survive? Right? Like imagine if you have a Ford F-150 and you swap it out with like an I-4 engine. Like that's not gonna last that long, man.
Yeah.
Like a little sedan. Right? I mean, like, maybe if it was, like, a Supra engine or something cool like that.
You know. I never thought about this till right now, but, like, with the New World dogs being completely replaced by Western, you know, European dogs coming over.
It's detection limits. It's all about detection limits.
Okay. So you think there is still a little bit of DNA there, like, in some dogs?
So, like, you look at, like, Asian dogs, right? Like, the Asian dog... Paleo, like ancient dogs from Asia, right? Like that, there's probably multiple dog domestication events in Asia and all this other stuff. But like, dogs are so closely related to one another. It's really, really tough to do that at the whole. I really think it might just be because, you know, well, at the same time, like, it could very well be the case that like dogs, you know, because of disease or something like that, maybe they were replaced. Who knows, man? But it's probably the case that they just mixed. And there's selection, but
okay. Because where I was going with that is like, if people don't understand like how Neanderthal, like you're still part Neanderthal, you know, with 2% DNA, whatever. Like, it's the same thing. Those dogs were dogs, and they had sex with American dogs, and like now that's just more European DNA than it is Amerindian DNA. So it's the same thing with humans and Neanderthals, at least to my
summation. I mean, like, look how many Cholos and like Chihuahuas and all those are Native American dogs. Like whether we want to admit it or not, there's huge amounts of gene flow, but they're Native American dogs. What's interesting to me though is in Chile, in Argentina, it looks like they possibly also domesticated foxes.
Yeah, so, Raven Garvey was trying to get me to work with that. Is that a good or bad face?
No, it's a face. Raven's brilliant. That would have just been such a cool project. No, because they did it. There was a taxidermy project where somebody found like one of these taxidermy like Fuegian dogs, and they sequenced the mitogenome of it, and they're like, dude, this thing's a fox. They're like, it's a fox, bro.
Damn. Because it's like, I get people ask about, like, people always comment about the Fuegian dogs and stuff on my Instagram, like, hey, do a thing on it. And I'm like, I would love to, but I want to actually go see one first.
Yeah, my original PhD project was supposed to be a Tierra Fuego in the Miami's, and going
doing what
there, man. I wanted to do cold climate adaptation down there, but it was just like political instability, funding, different field seasons. Like, it was really tough. And then also, I think there's something to be said about letting communities come to you, sort of deal. Like, I didn't like that. It takes a lot of rapport building to do it properly. And,
especially when you're doing like biological stuff where you're actually like measuring them, their persons, and you know, also you should be respectful of their heritage too. But if you're measuring their physical persons, like you have to be an uncertain level where you're like, okay, we're cool. Yeah, I can measure you. This is cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was just going to do like a SNP chip, but like at the same time, for good reason, there's a healthy distrust of biological anthropology. Was the scientific arm of colonialism. That's something we need to address 100%. Like, here's an example. I was photographing some crania for like a side project, and I was working with skulls from southern Italy. And like, these are my ancestors, right? They're like from a mile away from where my father was born. I pick them up, and a bunch of fava beans fall out of their head. And I'm like, oh, why are these people measuring endocrinium volume? Oh, they're trying to tell us why we're racially like bad and like not smart. They're trying to tell us you're going to compare size of our brains to the size of brains of people in Northern Europe, aren't they? And lo and behold, that's exactly what they did. So like, and like, that's like a low, like, you know, like I, whatever, like that's that. Now amplify that discomfort by 10,000 and be like, okay, anthropologist took your family away. Right. Like, you can't do that. I refuse to do that. And like, you, part of learning how to be a good scientist is learning how to develop a healthy, culturally and ethically sustainable research ethic or research like approach. And like not a lot of people do this. Have you guys spoken to Caleb Fox at all?
Uh-uh.
He's my buddy. He's a professor at UCSD. He's Native Hawaiian, Konkama Ali. He's like a killer scientist, exceptional scientist, like one of the best geneticists I've met. And the guy, you should have him on. He's great. He's like a geneticist.
Okay.
Geneticist. He also was trained as an archaeologist too. I'm pretty sure he went to Maryland for his undergrad or something like that. But
send us his digits.
I will. Yeah. No, like he was like having him sort of as like a side mentor was really important because like, you know, I approached him with these problems. I'm like, dude, like I don't feel comfortable. He's like, then don't do it, dude. Like use your intuition. If you don't feel comfortable doing something, don't do it. Like, you know why you don't feel comfortable. Don't do it. And like, not everybody has that. The amount of people I know who are like pressured into doing projects that they're not comfortable with is too damn high. Huh. So that's that.
That gets back into that whole academia being toxic kind of thing.
Yeah,
for sure. On many fronts.
Anyways, yeah. So Neanderthals. And then, well, I know number three, you asked if it was consensual. Probably was, dude. It was Henry. Henry Wright came up to me and was like, I have a hypothesis for why red hair exists. And I was like, let's hear it. He's like, well, it started when man went to Europe from Africa. And a man saw a red-headed Neanderthal and said, wow, that's a rat.
Isn't that actually the genetic case?
No, I don't really know, man. That's like, the good thing about science is that you have to prove stuff.
Yeah. Because I'd heard that red hair is a Neanderthal remnant trait, but I don't know if that's true or not.
Here's the thing about Neanderthals, man. Neanderthals lived from North Africa to England to Siberia for probably twice as long as we Homo sapiens have been alive. Okay. The big thing about Neanderthals is we like have them fixed at one point in time.
Sure.
Like, and that to me is like a form of racism. Like we have them fixed in their ability, fixed in their capacity, fixed in their behavior, fixed in their appearance. And like that's racist right there, straight up. Like there's no other like that. Like if you did that, if you applied that to any other human population today,
oh my God,
we would recognize it for what it is. And that's racism.
Right? I'm on notice. I never thought about that.
Yeah. So like that is one. So like I had a colleague who was like, Neanderthals didn't do that. And I was like, which Neanderthals? Like, this colleague was like, sure, yeah. Okay, well, we're a different species than them. I'm like, well, what do you mean we're a different species than them? And this person was like, oh, well, like, you know, we didn't mix with them. Like, yo, we mixed with them very extensively. And the person was like, oh, well, like, we have different ecology than them. Like, what do you mean we? What do you mean ecology? What do you mean by their ecology? You tell me that somebody from Siberia has the same ecology as somebody from Mount Carmel in Israel or from like England or from Iberia? No, no. And then on top of it, like people are now, here's one thing that's weird. It's like, we now know that like Neanderthals, like any other human group, had variation genetically. We know that they ate different things depending on where they live. You know, they look different depending on where they live. This is like blowing people's minds. This is blowing their mind. And like, in the same people who have their mind blown by that, have their mind blown by the fact that like Mesolithic humans in Europe had dark skin. You're like,
yeah.
The first people in Britain were black. It's like, dude, chill, man.
Yeah.
It's that crazy history of like Neanderthals where we put them as this caricature and then we never took them out of that box and we refused to take them out of that box.
Dude, if you went to the Neander Valley like 40,000 years ago and you found one of these guys and you asked him how he identified,
he'd say Johnny
he
Damon.
Or she. Yeah, he'd say Johnny Damon. No, he'd be like, he'd probably say something along the lines of like, I'm one of the people, right?
Sure.
And then you could find a person that we would call a Neanderthal from the opposite side of the range at that point in time. And you put them face to face, and he's going to be like, he's not one of the people. He doesn't speak the same language as me. He smells funny. He eats different food than me. He has different body adornments than me.
He likes turtles.
Why are you? He likes turtles, right? so Neanderthals, in some regards, are a social construct. So are Denisovans. We don't even know what Denisovans are. And we probably have Denisova, like, crania sitting on shelves, and we're calling them, like, Chinese Homo erectus or something like that.
Sure.
So, like, we just, like, apply these things and, like, expect everybody to jump on board. But, like, critically, like, if we take a step back, there's a paper written by Sheila Ethrea. I don't know how to pronounce her last name. But she did a paper with a co-author talking about human evolution, like, viewed from outside a Eurocentric sphere. And Ackerman is the other author.
That this sounds like a really fascinating read.
Dude, it is one of the best papers I've ever read. And, like, not only is, like the paper's like, listen to authors from China. Like, you can't just write off everything that Chinese authors are saying because you think it's nationalism. Because what you're doing is also nationalism. But, like, take into consideration the fact that, like, these people are identifying the fact that there are morphological traits in humans in China 200,000 years ago that you find in humans in China today.
Right.
That's not them saying the Chinese nation has been here for 200,000 years. This is saying there's regional continuity. And that's okay. That's okay. Like, just get over it. That's the big problem.
Okay. That's fascinating, dude. We got to wrap up here, but I just want to qualify before I get arrested. When I said it wasn't consensual, I was more asking, I think you and I had this talk when you helped me with the Neanderthal post that I did. And it's more likely, because I get so many comments saying that we would have just fought each other or, like, beat the shit out of each other. And, like, it's probably more the case of just, like you're saying, like, they just looked like a person. And they were like, let's bang, because, like, they were trying to trade stone. Well, you know, like, it's more likely that you're going to interact positively with a new group of humans than you would negatively.
Who knows? Maybe not. But, like, it doesn't necessarily. So there's literally zero evidence for physical violence between Neanderthals and people.
Yeah.
The amount of evidence is zero. It's an assumption. And I think part of it is you see these, like, uncontacted tribes of the Amazon and all that other stuff, which is, like, a whole different thing to unpackage, because, like, they have, like, they're wearing Nikes, dude. Like, they're not uncontacted.
Got my shit.
They're uncontacted by white people, dude. Like,
yeah.
They're uncontacted by Oxford. They're not uncontacted. Right?
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Right. So, like, yeah. I'll take a step back.
Yeah.
So my dog, Anatolian Shepherd, right? These dogs have been around for thousands of years, and they're bred to protect livestock against predation. There's this misconception that these dogs, like, go seek out wolves and kill them. It's not what they do. When they see a wolf or a coyote, this happened with my dog. There's a coyote in the neighborhood last year.
Yeah, you told me this, yeah.
Man, my dog bluff charged him. Okay? He made himself look big. He's like, yo, how you doing? Get out of my neighborhood. Okay? He popped himself up, put his hackles up, barked, and was like, get out of here. Right? And that was it. That's all he had to do. It was a nonviolent encounter. And that's what they're bred to do. They're bred to, like, minimize risk and, like, get rid of a threat. That's probably not dissimilar from what humans did 40,000 years ago. Like, yo, if you're not here, like, to trade or whatever, get out of here, dude. And that was probably the majority of the interaction. That was probably it. Probably took 30 seconds. You go home, like, yo, Grog, you're not going to believe what I just saw. This dude was, like, 6'3", and, like, beautiful. He had all teeth. And let me tell you, he was just wearing stuff, like, all over. He had, like, red and, like, yellow. It was cool. Anyways, I told him to run away and stay woke for a little bit, okay? But that's...
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Vincent, for coming on. Do you have any social media or Twitter you want to plug?
Yeah.
For people to follow you?
At Spaghetti Westerns with a Z, because, you know, I'm predictable.
And you started off the episode with the can of, what was it? What was the name of the beer?
Name of the beer is Ecstasy of Gold from Widowmaker Brewery here in Quincy, Mass, right down the street.
Nice.
And they're in Braintree, Matt. Sorry. Yeah.
In addition to breweries, do you have any citations or books or papers that you would recommend people read?
No. Of mine or other people's?
Just like to get into Neanderthals or, you know, genomics.
No, not Neanderthals, but you Italy. Need to read Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Mulcair. And you need to read Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe. And then we can talk about this critically if you want.
Okay. Man, I gotta think of a skit now where he's like, yo, I got a good Flint guy.
Look, you know, we tend to care more about the haft than the Flint. Okay, I'll tell you Flints, but a nice haft, a little bit of bitumen, you need that anaerobic environment. Ooh, mama mia, that's great stuff.
My cousin Mikey using this at lateral. These guys over here, they've been using the freaking bow.
Can I ask you, Arkiel? I know you're probably going to cut this off.
Thank you so much for coming on. Yeah, we just interviewed Vince Batista. You can find him at The Things in The Thing. Rate, review the podcast. We'll give you things. And with that, we are out.
Rate the podcast.
Thanks for listening to A Life in Ruins podcast.
You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at A Life in Ruins podcast. And you can also email us at alifeinruinspodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, make sure to bring your archaeologists in from the cold and feed them beer. All right, since Carlton's not here to introduce this, this is shitty joke time. So I heard this recently. There's a guy going around at the moment like dipping his testicles in glitter. It's pretty nuts.
Wow.
Wow, that's like a Kesha concert with one joke right there.
That's a good reference. All right, on that note, guys, we're out. Maybe I'll be here next week, maybe I won't. Bye.
1 was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.